You are listening to Mantra and Magic,
the podcast where Eastern philosophy meets Western magical practice.
Each week, we will introduce you to concepts, people, and tools that we hope will bring you into closer alignment with your true nature and your divine self.
We are your hosts, Amy Solara and Jeremy Renta. Welcome to the show.
Welcome to another episode of Mantra and Magic. Today, I am barely containing the amount of energy in my human form because I'm getting to talk to one of my greatest teachers, and I've been pestering Jeremy to meet her in her words, like in all the written stuff she's done, for years. Even when he lived with me, I was taking one of my first courses with her. And for everybody who's been a client of mine, you've heard me harp about this. And when the book came out, you've had it thrown at you. And when I got the opportunity to be part of her monthly program, I snatched it up as fast as I could because I said, I'm going to get all the magic that I can out of this lifetime. And one of the things that I absolutely love is if you've listened to our first season and the episodes where I talk about being a witch and I talk about stepping into that power and what that title means to me, you heard me talk about how much I love Hermes Trismegistus and how much I love Thoth and how much I identify as a hermetic witch and that that's the type of witchcraft I love to do. And part of that journey was hugely influenced by our guest today, Carolyn Elliott, who is the writer of an amazing book called Existential Kink. And she is a doctor, and her PhD may not seem completely related to magical work, but it actually is because it studies people. It goes into your brains and it's so cool. And you can find her magazine online, which has lots of really great contributors. And I love that when you type it in, it says badwitch.es. I was like, this is genius. So you can go straight to that website and find lots of amazing resources and listicles, which I learned that word from her in Thrill. That's what that's called. So thank you so much for joining us today, Carolyn.
Thank you, Amy. Thank you, Jeremy, for having me.
So we want to go way back to when you first started writing about being a witch online, how you stepped into that space of acknowledging that magic was the key thing and that you didn't have to hide anymore.
Oh, wow. Yeah, that was a big step for me back then. It's kind of funny to think about because I'm like so used to it now. But I remember I had just gotten out of my PhD program and I was just scraping by as a freelance writer. And I remember I had this big anxiety in my brain because I was still applying for like these online freelance writing jobs all the time. I was like, if people Google my name and find witch all over it, they will never want to hire me for these little freelance gigs. So I remember I had all this anxiety about it, but I finally got to the point where I was like, I don't want any more shitty freelance gigs. I didn't know if it was possible. I was like, something in me felt like it was possible to make a living teaching magic online. I had no evidence of that necessarily. I don't know if I knew of anybody who was doing it, but I was just like, if I can't do this, I guess I'll just starve and die because I really do not want to do anything else. I've really tried everything else to do that I could think of, not so into it. Let's just go ahead and jump into this. So it was sort of a little bit of a burn the bridges kind of thing, but I had already burned a bunch of bridges. I had already made myself intolerably annoying to the people in academia and gotten myself kind of they didn't really kick me out. I mean, they gave me my PhD, but then when I applied for teaching jobs, they were like, no, really, we have had enough of you. Please go away. And, you know, at the time I was like, ouch, guys. But like now I'm like, oh, hallelujah. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you so much for like booting me out of the nest because I obviously need a different venue. So, yeah.
So good. I love that. Like the universe said, no, that's not going to fly anymore. You don't get to have your tweed jacket and your nice office hours.
Womp womp. Yeah, I know. It was like, you just have to go be a random weirdo on the internet, Carolyn. Just, you know, that was so funny for me. But it was such an ego death because I really was like so attached to like the institutional prestige or whatever. And I had so deeply fantasized about the tweed jackets and the conferences and tenure and everything like that. And as it became clear to me that all of that was just like, actually not really real anymore for anyone. Like maybe there's like gonna be like two people in the next 10 years who get tenure, I don't know. But like, just that it was, I realized that it was a giant pyramid scheme. Like, you know, they bring in all these people for the PhD programs and make them teach the whatever adjunct courses they don't pay anything for. And then they make all of those PhDs compete for the like one little tenure spot. So it's kind of funny, like now I'm in the coaching industry, in the online teaching industry, and sometimes people are like, oh, it's a pyramid scheme. And I'm like, honey, this pyramid scheme ain't nothing compared to academia. Like here, people are competing around actual money. There, they're competing for like crumbs of approval from like bitter.
Yeah, and getting published in like journals that nobody reads. Nobody reads them. That used to be my goal in life too. I used to, like when I was 10, I said, I'm going to get a PhD by the time I'm 30, and went for it so hard. And then last year in grad school, sat in my first ayahuasca ceremony. I was like, I'm done.
Yeah, good, good. I'm so happy for you. I'm so, so happy for you. Yeah, grandmother ayahuasca is a way, way, way better teacher than most of those teachers. Is.
And it's, yeah, it's not a pyramid scheme on that front. So it's just genuine. That's how Jer and I met.
Oh, cool. Ceremony. Amazing. Well,
it seems like there's a lot of ego death, like you said, involved in that, especially when it comes to getting into school, going and having 7 years in schooling to try to be a part of something that has all of these laws and rules that you have to follow after you're done too. Like that's a big problematic issue. How did you kind of embrace that and just kind of like letting all of that stuff go and diving into like approaching things from a witchy standpoint, from more of a magical standpoint?
Yeah. So, I mean, I definitely left giant claw marks in it. I did not let go gracefully. I was not like, oh, it's okay, I'll just leap into the unknown. I was like, so it was a process though. It was, I gradually realized like as I was writing my dissertation that I didn't want to be in academia. So I started writing a book called Awaken Your Genius, which is sort of like a cult favorite creativity book. And I started getting involved in psychedelic groups, which was funny. At the time I was in 12-step recovery, so I was not partaking of any psychedelics, but I only wanted to hang out with other people who were. So I was in this group where I actually met the man who is now my wonderful husband, called Evolver, which was started by Daniel Pinchbeck, and they had a magazine called Reality Sandwich. I think the magazine is still up. And it was just all about like 2012 and, you know, my consciousness expansion. So I got involved in like organizing events for that group and started to try to get connected to people in the sort of ceremonial scenes. So I thought about just leaving without my PhD, like that was sort of an option, but I just didn't want to. I just was like, God damn it, I've given you so much of my blood, sweat, and tears, you're gonna give me those letters.
Yes.
So I did all sorts of I basically like steamrolled my way into like making them give me that degree before I left. But I was kind of like done with it before I got it. And then it was just like this weird, it was like I knew that I wanted magic and mystery, but I had no idea how to turn that into something that could, you know, also pay bills and sustain me. So I remember one year, I think it was like 2013, I was so inspired. I'd been doing this like intense Kundalini meditation all the time, just like raising this energy up my spine. And I didn't know that there's a thing called mania or hypomania that can be induced by a lot of intense Kundalini meditation and not sleeping and eating very much. I just didn't know that. I had always been a very depressive person. And when I started getting all this energy, I was just like, hey, great, I'm cured. And I don't even really like those terms, hypomania or mania, so much, but they're like clinical, you know, psychiatric terms. What I experienced, though, was definitely a an unusual state, let's say. I entered in the summer of 2013, I entered into this very expanded state where I could no longer really hear my inner monologue. Instead, I was kind of self-identified as a thunderstorm goddess for a period of about 2 months. Like, I would sit on my little balcony and I would hear the summer thunderstorms, and it was like the thunder was my thoughts, and I was like monologuing around town in the voice of the thunder goddess. And in this state, I was like, oh, I'll give up my apartment. I'll give away all my clothes and books. I'll quit this dumb freelance writing job I'm doing. And I will hitchhike to the Rainbow Gathering in Montana, because that sounds like a cool, epic thing to do. And I had just taken Bodhisattva vows, and I was like, I will fulfill my Bodhisattva mission in this way, somehow, was my thought. So I gave away my apartment, all my books and clothes, quit my job, tried to get out to Montana for the Rainbow Gathering, totally failed. All my rides, all my plans fell through. Ended up living on the couch of some kind friends of mine in a kind of grody part of town. And then I got involved in a sex cult called One Taste. Which was really weirdly had a presence in Pittsburgh, which I actually kind of attribute to this really intense solstice. I did this big public solstice ritual also in 2013 to rebalance the masculine and the feminine energies. And it was this created this big controversy in my little Pittsburgh community. I felt, so this orgasm cult showed up in fucking Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Their other locations were LA, New York, London. And like, how did they get to Pittsburgh other than weird solstice magic, right? So anyway, so they were there and I got involved, and it was all about a practice called orgasmic meditation, which is an awesome practice, highly recommend. The culty stuff was, you know, sometimes
it's what culty stuff is. Yeah.
It's what culty stuff is. Yeah. It's
power like games and lots of intrigue.
Yes. Yes. So no shade on the practice. And they taught me a lot of beautiful things. They also had a lot of like fun, high pressure sales craziness going on. But that group was really into magic, and that was not in their like corporate branding at all. But as you started to like get sort of closer in there, I realized that actually the lineage of teaching was very connected to like some far out Crowley stuff. Basically, I like to call it, you know, California sex magic lineage, going from, I believe, Jack Parsons and Marjorie Cameron's influence with the Agape Lodge into like various LSD scenes in California, into the Morehouse movement, became this One Taste thing. So actually this very potent, very interesting strain of magic.
I feel like you brought us around to something that's huge for a lot of people that I've encountered in the wealth community, whether we're doing our power-ups or we're communicating in Mighty Network or we're doing our gift exchanges where we've got sessions with each other, and we always talk about strokes. And yeah. So I feel like you just brought us to that with orgasmic meditation. And but like, I would love for you to elaborate on how like you found yourself there, or you seemingly found yourself there, right? Because at that time you didn't realize you had the choice and free will to then take responsibility and be there. But you were in that space and doing that meditation, you realized that applied to everything in life.
Yes. Yes. So the practice of orgasmic meditation is a very sort of interesting thing. I like to think of it as a kind of a Zen version of Tantra, that it's very pared down. And it involves a woman opening, butterflying her legs open and having her clitoris stroked in this very regimented way. Like, there's latex gloves, there's a specific kind of lube, there's timers, there's like a protocol for everything. It's like this very set container, 15 minutes. And it's brilliant because it's like, you know, the clitoris is literally like has the most nerve endings in a human form. So you start to discover that there's a range of sensation that everybody has. Everybody has a different range of sensation. Or I should say every person with clitoris, every woman, however language is tough these days, has a certain range of sensation that they are willing to receive as pleasurable. So it could be the same very light touch on the clitoris, and one woman, you know, will love it, and another woman will find it intolerable. And so I've spent, I don't know, at least hundreds of hours doing this practice. I mean, it was pretty great practice. Like, when people were like, hey, Carolyn, do you want to sign up for this thing? We'll stroke your clitoris 2 hours a day. I was like, yes. So, in lots of fairness to one taste, it was not me who came up with the notion that that the practice was analogous to life. That was definitely the founders and the teachers. You know, one of the main teachers was Nicole Dedone. Another one was Ken Blackman. Another one was Rob Candel. And Ken and Rob have their own things. I'm not sure what Nicole is doing these days. I think she's working on a book. Bless her. I love her very, very much. When I say One Taste is a cult, Nicole, if you're hearing this, you know what I mean. And don't be mad. Okay. So anyways, so they would talk about how life, you know, is a series of strokes, and it's possible to get off on every stroke. And they would do demonstrations. Nicole would actually do a demonstration on people, on this one person in particular. Rachel did demonstrations a lot, and would stroke her in front of like an audience of hundreds of people sometimes. And it would be like a virtuoso performance. It would be like a symphonic kind of experience. And you would feel like the electricity and the energy of the orgasm filling the room. And Rachel had a capacity to get off on a whole lot of different strokes. So that's sort of what Nicole was demonstrating. And of course, also the sensitivity of the stroker. So they would talk about this concept. And I got really, really curious about it, because oftentimes people would say to me like, wow, Carolyn, you really turn yourself off. They also had this concept of like turn on and turn off, and really brilliant. Like, and the idea is just basically that because there's a small range of sensation that most people are willing to get off on, when we encounter sensation that is outside of that usual range, instead of being like, yes, awesome, it's, you know, we might shut ourselves down and be like, I don't like that. Stop that, universe. Stop that person. And it's just like, and people also pointed out to me like, hey, Carolyn, like, they used to joke about witching it. And one day we were like, our little Pittsburgh crew was on our way to a thing in San Francisco we were supposed to go to. And I think it was like, I tell the story different times. People have to remember that I have a very loose grip on space-time, and I don't mean to fictionalize things, but it just kind of happens. Anyways, multiple tires on this car blew out on our way to the airport. And that morning before we left, I had been like, I don't want to go. Why do we have to go to San Francisco all the time? Why don't they come here? It's expensive. I don't like the airport. Whiny jerk. And so when the tires blew out on our way to the airport, everybody turned around and was like, Carolyn, why did you witch that? And I was sitting there and I was like, all right, first of all, dumbasses, you should have gotten your tires checked. I didn't do anything. Obviously, I was just sitting here. And but people would do this. They would point out to me over and over again how, Carolyn, you always get what you want in some level. Things happen. Things rearrange themselves to match your desires at some level, whether you fully own it or not. And I started to see that there was a truth to this. And I started to get really curious about it. So at the time, I was still scraping by for money. I was like paying for all this culty stuff with like credit cards and, you know, stuff like that. I was still scraping by and not feeling really good and confident in life. I started to get really curious, and I was like, well, if I'm able to you know, which things, like the tires blowing out and like stuff like that. Maybe I could witch having lots of money, having a relationship with a man that was really great. Maybe I could do that. How do I do that? So I started getting really curious, and I started to figure out that if I could get off on more strokes, I could keep myself in more of an open, turned on, receptive condition. And because I noticed that my closed down state sort of like closed down the flow of good stuff, and that I would kind of habitually close that down. So I started to practice receiving the events and experiences of life as strokes from a metaphorical divine lover who was just always touching, just that my being was just one big clitoris, just perpetually being touched by the universe, like the rainy day, the bill in the mail, you know, just everything.
It's very tantric, and it's very like, it's weird because when we think of tantras, when we think of like tantric practices in the West, it's like there's the cult aspect, like you're talking about the culture of it, whether it's Kali or any of the Hindu pantheons that kind of follow that. But you don't necessarily think of the individual experience of the tantric practitioner, right? So what you're doing is you're literally taking both poles, the extreme of like, everybody knows how to do this, and this is the one person who's actually experiencing this, and trying to kind of find that balance in between.
Yeah, beautiful point. Yeah, trying to find a way to really connect everything that they were talking about and have a really embodied experience of it. And there were other people who were also doing that in the group. One of them is my dear friend still today, Leslie Rogers, runs the Light Dark Institute, which is like an in-person kink thing he taught recently in Wealth. So anyways, I started figuring out that it was possible for me to get off on how broke and pathetic and humiliated and rejected that I felt all the time. And that by doing that, I really liberated a ton of energy, like that there was like literally orgasmic energy that would pour out of me when I really opened up to being like, to not shaming the fact that, hey, there's a part of me that is really attached to this, that finds this really compelling and attractive. Okay, let's just give that permission to be fully present in my body. And then, the synchronous experience of my life changed very dramatically, very quickly. And I like to think that that's connected to, basically, I changed my felt embodied meaning that I assign to everything. So not just the mental meaning, but like my felt experience, that meaning became fulfilled, empowered, orgasmic, luxurious, pleasurable, delightful. And as that started to happen, the events surrounding me started to reflect that instead of reflecting, you know, pathetic, rejected, scarce, frustrated, tragic, you know, which I had been reflecting before.
And well, there's this weird kind of like zero sum game that comes with our shame as well, right? It's like there's these things that we want to hide, and we get to experience it in ourselves, but we are afraid to share that we enjoy it, that we're enjoying being broke, or that we... Like one of the things that I really resonated with, it's very, at the very beginning of the book, it was like examples of people who you've dealt with, like Alex, the guy who was like wanted to be taken care of by other women. And I was like, fuck me, that's exactly what my life has been like. My mom bought my cars. I've had partners who have taken care of me. And it's like, I lived with Amy and her husband now for a year, you know, like there's just been these examples of me not willing to see the things that I actually wanted to, or be excited about it. Instead, it's just kind of like, no, this is something that I have to be ashamed of and I have to hide. And there's like this, sorry to just kind of jump into this, but there's this weirdness for me too, that it's like the actual completion of whatever the project is also very dissatisfying, right? I'm very much of a journey person. But for me to say that, that means that I never get to completely enjoy the accomplishment, the actual fulfillment of whatever the actual end goal is. So like being able to completely let go of your expectations of whatever the outcome is going to be is incredibly hard to do as well, you know? So there's what I keep coming back to in my mind with what you're talking about here is the, again, that tantric aspect of being able to exist inside of both of the, inside of the entire experience and not be tied to the fact that you want to be wealthy or that you want to be broke, like just kind of being here and being present in it. Like, do you still find that that's difficult now even?
Oh, yeah. So there's always, so just when I get to the point, the place where I'm like, okay, I can be here right now. I can be right on the spot. That's what they used to call it in orgasmic meditation, right on the spot. I can do that with some stuff. And then there's still some stuff that's just like still outside of my range. And it's really, really hard for me to be like totally dropped in and receptive and present with, for sure. I'm definitely a lot more spacious than I used to be. I'm definitely able to be receptive to a lot more than I was. But I love what you're saying. Like, it's because of all the shaming and all the conditioning, it's like we're taught that there's like this much stuff in life that is okay and right.
Joy is acceptable. Yeah.
Yeah. So tiny, such a little tiny thing. And meanwhile, our bodies and our souls, so our egos usually go along with that program, right? Like, oh, okay, you're right, society, you're right, parents, there's only this small amount that I should enjoy. Meanwhile, our bodies and our souls are capable of fucking enjoying like everything. So I see magic and I see this alchemical process of being a really, really big work of humbling our egos to the truth of our actual embodied, ensouled experience. And, you know, setting aside those like egoic shoulds about what it's okay to enjoy, what it's okay to get off on. And this goes really, really, really deep. There's, I feel like there's so many sources of pleasure for us that are so, so deeply taboo. And yet the fact that they're taboo does not make them stop being sources of pleasure. It just keeps them repeating. Like, oh boy, am I gonna actually talk about this? Okay, I might talk about this. Here we go. I've been thinking a lot about, you know, discourse surrounding privilege and all of the, you know, very, very painful, traumatic, tragic ways that this continued reinscription of certain groups of people having power and certain other groups of people really encountering so much difficulty and so much, you know, shame and barriers to their flourishing. And I was thinking about this phenomenon of, you know, white guilt, right? Where so many people who are well-intentioned want, they see that this issue and they want to make it better, but then they go right into like savior complexes, or they go into like this kind of grandstanding, or, you know, something. It gets very like weird very fast. And I've been contemplating this, and I've been contemplating, you know, because somebody was talking to me, that I've coached was talking to me about the shadow of privilege and integrating the shadow. And I was thinking about it, and I was like, I'm not really sure if privilege itself is in the shadow. I feel like you would have to be a really stupid white person to think that you were, to be completely unconscious of the fact that you had things easier than, you know, people of color or other, you know, groups. But I was like, what is it that we don't like to own and feel and acknowledge that is part of that? Of that, you know, what we call privilege, or and I was thinking it has a lot to do potentially with the fact that we all have, you know, we all evolved from animals, right? We have animal ancestors, including reptilian ancestors. And I think it's hilarious that there's some like kind of conspiracy theory groups that are like, oh, it's all the reptilians. Those nasty reptilians, they're doing it to us.
I have a like, friend who was like, okay, don't be racist.
You mean the reptilian part of the human brain that's in everyone? Okay.
The amygdala?
Right, exactly. Exactly. But yeah, so we all have this part of us that is humans are apex predators. Humans apparently are the most territorial of primates. We've proven that again and again. I suspect that a lot of what we call racism today is maybe a little bit closer, perhaps a more accurate term might be xenophobia, you know, like connected to a fear of like, oh, somebody's from another group, another clan than me. I don't know what's going on with them. I don't know what their, you know, customs are. I don't know what their health is. I don't know how that will affect me, whatever. I think there's sort of like a reactive animal level xenophobia and predatoriness and territorialness that is just in humans, that is just like part of our animal heritage and is not necessarily unique to any group. But historically, in say like the United States, certainly the European peoples kind of got on top militarily and let their predatoriness and their territorialness have its field day. And we're all still living in the results of that. And I just find it very interesting. There's a way in which I think that, and I'm still searching for the language for it that does enough. It's so difficult to talk about these non-dual things, especially in today's very polarized environment. But I think that the reactivity that keeps many people from fully understanding or from being fully compassionate to the struggles that people of other groups go through and from, you know, doing enough to change the legislation and the just general social environment, I think it has to do with we don't know how to give ourselves permission to get off on our ancestors' reptilian, primate, animal levels of success with their territoriality and their predatoriness and their, you know, whatever like base level survival program they were operating on.
Well, also, it doesn't have to always get to genocide, right? It's like, It's like, can't we just cohabitate?
Well, exactly. And so my sense is that it's certainly possible for humans to operate from compassion and from generosity and not to operate strictly from that reptilian or whatever mammalian stuff. But it's like, we don't get there by shaming ourselves for our animal elements. Like we get there from an overflow of love, like from an overflow of acceptance, from an overflow of joy.
Well, this also seems to be where magic comes from, right? Like magic is symbolism. It comes from intention. It comes from like the baser elements. We talk about earth, wind, fire, water, and that stuff is pre-verbal, right? We've tried to put language on top of it and put, you know, whatever Sanskrit or Hebrew or whatever the things are that we're trying to use as a way for us to understand it. But all that stuff comes through in our dreams. You know, we don't do a lot of reading in our dreams. And if we do, it's like, this is the way we figured out how to communicate with you. And by we, I mean our HDA, which I would kind of also like to talk at some point about.
Yeah, I was like, we have to get to Crowley. We have to get to LBRP.
Okay. Oh, boy. Oh, you guys. So, my kind of people.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was a wealth call or if it was something else recently, you were talking about how it was happening in your dreams, like the shift was starting to happen. You were doing these practices on the outside. Maybe you were doing like even Tonglen and all of that kind of stuff. And you started to notice you kept ending up in the same dream space. Like, can you talk about that? Because that's so much fun. I love that notion. You kept going to the same location and then like how you started to engage with them. You're like, why am I here?
Yes. No, thank you for asking this, Amy. So this is one of my favorite things about magic. And actually, Alan Chapman talks about this a bit in Advanced Magic for Beginners, which is one of my favorite books on magic, which is that magic always works. It always works. Sometimes it doesn't take its effects in the material form. Sometimes it takes its effects in the dream world. But one of the really interesting things about Hermetic magic, like the famous Lesser Banishing Ritual of the Pentagram, aka the Conjuration of the Four Kings, and the Middle Pillar and things like that, is they are aligned with, well, back in the day in the 19th century, they used to call them the secret chiefs, and they used to call them inner planes contacts, which I just find so cute. It was so adorable. But they used to talk about this, like, if you do these practices, you will meet the secret chiefs. You will attain the inner planes contacts. And I remember reading about that and being like, oh, such a bunch of 19th century, whatever. And then my husband just kept bugging me about, like, not having a rigorous enough practice. He was like, why don't you do some traditional blah, blah, blah magic? And I was like, fine, I'll do the Golden Dawn stuff. It'll make you shut up. Here I go. Okay, so I love you, Taya. So I started doing the Golden Dawn stuff, the lesser banishing ritual and the middle pillar. And within a few months, I found that I was regularly having dreams where I was visiting. It looked like Lake Chautauqua in upstate New York. It looked like a nice summer camp that was very wholesome and very much about like here's where we go listen to lectures, and here's where we go to have vegetarian Indian food in the cafeteria, and here's where we go on our little boating events on the lake. And it was the Golden Dawn summer camp. There was like the Golden Dawn regalia was everywhere. There was like the Rosicrucian symbols. And you know, one night I was at this, oh man. I was at a talent show. There were like people astral projecting at this fun little Golden Dawn talent show. They were like going from one end of the stage to another. Anyways, so that was happening. And I was also having some repeated dreams where I was on a spaceship with David Bowie. And I love David Bowie. David Bowie like got me through my childhood. Just his music really uplifted me. And I never knew, even after I started doing the Golden Dawn magic, and even though I loved David Bowie growing up, I did not know that David Bowie was a Thelemite. Like, for example, his last album, Black Star, is like sheer, like, Thelemic gospel kind of stuff. It was like very, very intense. And I guess apparently throughout his career, he really felt himself connected to Crowley and connected to the whole New Aeon vision of like the Aeon of Horus is the Aeon of the hermaphrodite, the crowned and conquering child, the union of the mother and the father principle in this sort of non-binary way. And he, you know, enacted that in his art and his music. I really didn't know that. But I was having dreams where I was with David Bowie on David Bowie's spaceship. And we'd be like driving through these like beautiful alien landscapes. And in a lot of these dreams, I would just be like, God damn, I'm so cool. I'm on David Bowie's spaceship. I'm the best. That was like what most of those dreams were. But then one time I was with him and he was looking out a window. He was like, astrology is so different in space. And I was like, wow, David Bowie, I never thought of that before. I guess it is. Yeah, man. And that happened. And then I don't know what led me to do this, but I was like, I was reading something by Lon Milo Duquette, who I really love. He's a Thelemic.
He's one of our favorites too.
Yeah. And it's so funny because like Aleister Crowley was like the biggest asshole ever. And like Lon Milo Duquette is like the biggest sweetheart ever. It's just so funny. Like that they're both Thelemic teachers. Anyways, so I was reading one of his books and he started talking about how, you know, Thelemic magic grew out of Golden Dawn magic. But Golden Dawn magic, all of the rituals center the performer of the rituals on the earth. And so there's astrological associations with different gestures in the ritual, but they're earth-centered. Whereas one of Crowley's twists, the game, was in Thelemic ritual, the magician is figured as standing on the sun. And so all the astrological gestures have different associations because of the standing on the sun. And I read this and I got like, waves of chills over my body. And I was like, David Bowie was telling me to do Thelema.
Oh my and, gosh, I'm so glad you said that. Like, just not to like completely jump on your story, but
yeah,
the first time that I was ever like in a magic class, I was paying, it was in North Hollywood in this like rinky dinky little magic store upstairs, and there were like 10 of us in the class, and the first time they said go to like your grounding place, go to your place of power, I really thought it was going to be like near the ocean or something else. I was standing on the sun, and it was just like, and I never put those two together until like this moment right now. So
yeah, that's a big realization. Well, you would really like Thelemic Magic by Lon Milo Duquette, because he
I just avoided, like, there's so many podcasts where I'm like, but not Crowley. Don't let me get near Crowley.
Don't let me get caught up in that. I know. Look, when I was a kid growing up, there was the only occult store in Pittsburgh. I didn't know it, but it was run by a Crowley fan, and it was all Crowley all the time. And I didn't even understand. I would go in there for like incense and peacock feathers and stuff. And I would be like looking around for like cool books about, I don't know what I wanted, like Llewellyn books on love spells or something. There was none of that there. There was just like weird old Crowley books. And I would like pick it up and look at it and like try to read it and I'd be like, what is this creep on about? Like, there was nothing attractive to me about Crowley. I mean, talk about like a controversial person. He was like every form of offensive. And it is kind of scary to be associated with him, but it was like, I don't know what to do. I am, and that is my lineage. My lineage involves these freaky, controversial people, including Nicole Daydone, including Aleister Crowley. And just to circle back a little bit real quick, I'm sort of sad that orgasmic meditation isn't like a thing that's taught anymore. I think one taste got like super sued in like all different places and they couldn't teach their workshops live. I think that they're trying to bring it back somehow. But anyways, it's a beautiful practice and it does give you a very tangible experience of this thing that I talk about in Existential Kink, which is expanding the range that we get off on. But sex magic, I mean, Crowley was super all about sex magic and all about the solar center and the solar identification as like the new aeon thing. And I'm so excited about that. I get like waves of optimism that I never anticipated being able to have in my life, because I've realized through doing existential kink work and, you know, teaching people in wealth and in the Sovereigns coach training program, all the things, it is actually possible for people to learn how to make the unconscious conscious pretty damn quickly. And that is so exciting, because that to me is the essence of the new aeon. That is how we make the hermaphrodite. That is how we get the alchemical gold and the solar identification. That's how we get to be centered at Tiphereth, right? I saw you guys had a cool Kabbalah episode. Yeah. Get centered at Tiphereth and get to be in our hearts and not knocked out anymore by, you know, the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune that usually knock us out of the heart all the time.
She's getting Shakespearean on us.
I bet he was into all of us. I mean, he was there with Edward Kelly, right? He like had to be.
Oh, Shakespeare? Oh, yeah. I think The Tempest was about John Dee, was the inspiration for Prospero and Tempest, right? Yeah. So
I know, let's all take a deep breath. We got like 13 minutes left in this hour.
Yeah, so it's funny because it's like, it's cool to make fun, like a lot of people in the occult scene will make fun of New Agers or whatever, but like more and more I find myself like I am a super New Ager in the sense that like I am feeling this new aeon, like I feel it. And of course it's a lot different than the fluffy stuff that some people mean when they talk about like ascension, and I don't know, I mean maybe that's all how it's going to go down, maybe we'll all, it'll be all, but I definitely think it involves some underworld journeying too. And
can you talk a little bit about that Persephone remything that you did?
Sure, my deep pleasure. So I wrote about this, and it's a neat introduction to the EK book. But so one day I was pondering the myth of Pluto and Persephone, Hades and Persephone. And I was reading, I forget where I was reading it, but it was something about how for thousands of years in Greece, before anybody ever thought of, hey, let's have a god of the underworld, he can be Hades and we'll have Zeus and all of that. Before any of that, there was like one primary goddess and her name was Kore, which means like the heart, the core of everything. And is also a name that later became associated with the maiden Persephone, Kore. So I was thinking about this and I was like, wait, what now? I was like, there used to be just one goddess. And then there's this story about how this goddess is kidnapped by this. So the goddess, you know, Kore was the goddess of the underworld. She was the goddess of the above world. She was the goddess of everything, you know, existence. And I was like, but now there's the story of like, she's just an innocent little girl and she gets kidnapped by this big evil raper and she gets brought down into the underworld. I was like, what is that about? And I was just like really holding that in my heart. And I got sort of this vision of a different understanding of that story. And so the classic version of the story is, Persephone is the daughter of Demeter, the goddess of grain and the harvest, and she's playing in a beautiful meadow in Mount Olympus one day, and the earth shakes open, and out of it comes big, strong Hades in his chariot, possessed with evil lust, and he grabs this young girl, and he takes her down into the underworld, and her mother is standing there crying and beating her breast. And he, you know, takes her down to the underworld, marries her against her will, i.e. rapes her. And she is miserable and she wants to go back to her home on Mount Olympus. But she is down in the underworld and she's hungry and there's these fruit trees. And, you know, if you eat the food of the underworld, you have to stay in the underworld. So she can't resist, she gives into the temptation and she eats 6 pomegranate seeds. And then because of that, even after her mother Demeter finds her and demands that she be returned to Mount Olympus, she can only be with her mother on Mount Olympus for 6 months out of the year, during which time Demeter is happy and we have spring and summer. And then the other 6 months of the year, Demeter is really sad that she's separated from her daughter who's in hell with her raper. So we have fall and winter. I never really liked that story. I always thought that story kind of sucks. And I read this little fact about, you know, the Kore being this ancient goddess and existing before anybody ever talked about Hades or anything else. And I just got this intuitive understanding of one day. So this is my version of the Persephone and Hades story. One day, the great all goddess got a little bit bored of being fully omnipotent and omniscient and in control of everything and enjoying everything perpetually. And she was like, you know what? I really want to experience how powerful and scary and intense I am. I don't have a way of experiencing that since I just am myself all the time. So I wonder what it's like to be opposed by me and all of my insane, you know, force and desire and strength and willfulness. And, you know, so she divided herself into a really, really innocent young girl and a really, really big, scary, nasty old guy. And she went ahead and experienced this drama playing out of, you know, being the kidnapper and the kidnapped and all of the strife, and also being Demeter, the mother who lost her child, and all of the emotion, all of the pain, all of the adrenaline, all of the shock, all of the confusion and the disorientation, which usually she would never get to experience because she was the all and knew everything and felt completely, you know, safe and blissful all the time. So instead she created this other experience. And she went through the experience, and then she was in the underworld and she saw the pomegranate seeds. And the pomegranate is really interesting, right? It's like this crazy fractal thing that just looks like wombs within wombs within wombs. So in my version of the story, Persephone eats the 6 pomegranate seeds, and 6 is the number of the heart, of the solar heart of Tiphereth on the Tree of Life. And pomegranates are also sometimes a metaphor for the Sephiroth of the Tree of Life. So she eats of the heart, Sephiroth. She eats the number 6, which is also the number of perfection. And she realizes the total perfection. She remembers herself. She remembers, brings herself into wholeness again by realizing that she is her mother, she is Demeter, and she is her rapist, she is Hades, and that she created this entire experience, not to be a jerk, not to fuck with herself necessarily, but honestly, because she wanted to feel. And she wanted to have an adventure in duality, because otherwise, you know, it's like the talking head said, like, heaven is a place where nothing ever happens. She wanted something to happen. And so she gave herself that. And she realizes in this moment that not only is Hades not evil, he's like such a devoted dimension of herself that he's willing to play this villain role. Just to fulfill this wish that she has for this deep, profound, dramatic experience of loss and remembrance. So she eats this and she is restored to this divine knowledge. And then she gets to go forth still experiencing herself as an individual, as, you know, Persephone, with a mother and with a husband, but now experiencing them as individuated facets of herself instead of tragic or threatening or whatever other people. So
the ability to be the observer and the observed.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And the to ability not be to be liked.
Yeah.
That,
yeah.
Like when I read that myth, and it, because I took Money and Thrill first, and then your book came out. And so I had heard you mention this story like in passing, but it didn't click until I was doing one of the steps in Money where you have to take on all the anger and all the hatred and all the blame of the world. And I didn't realize that until that point, until that exercise, how much I had just been like, no, no, never. I could never be hated. And I was like, oh, that's what Hades does. And that's why he's lovable, because everybody hates him. Nobody wants to die. Oh my gosh. And then I fell in love with him. And that's why I love this story that you intuited, because it's like, oh, that's me.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We all include death, right? And we all include this villainous dimension. And
girl, I got Pluto on my son. I know all about that.
Oh, yeah. That's intense, brother. Yeah. Yeah. Well, you must get a lot of those Plutonic projections, I imagine.
I spend a lot of time dealing with or embracing death. Yeah. And that was something else I realized too, with all of the stuff with the Existential Kink program. It's it comes easy for some people, right? The death, the part that most people fear, comes easy for some of us. And that means that being miserable is super easy for me, but being happy and being content and being taken care of or taking care of myself is really difficult, because, you know, you can't do that if you're literally 2 degrees off. Pluto's 2 degrees off from my son. So And my Mercury is also there too. So there's, I like to talk about it. I want to discuss how life is about death, and that's all that it is. So nothing matters, and saving money doesn't matter, and the Wall Street's bullshit, and like, it's telling people that they're not their story, but then making that my story. So.
Well, I wish you tons and tons of plutonic get off and joy also. I hear you. It's so interesting. It's like you're in touch with a big like piece of truth that's like really forbidden in modern American culture. And I do think that there is joy, a lot of joy and bliss tucked into that truth somewheres.
Yeah.
Just let yourself get on the spot with it.
Oh my goodness. Well, we're almost at time, and it makes me sad, but also very joyful because we did this and it's great. Are people who wanting to do this shift and do this work, like EK as a basic practice, they can get your book, they can read all the steps, or they can listen to it on Audible. Is there anything else that you're like, okay, this is the next thing to do, like out of all the different steps that you created?
Thank you, Amy. I love that question. Yeah, so if people read Existential Kink and they really like it, my first suggestion would be for them to come join Wealth, which should open, I think, twice this year. It's going to open on March 22nd for application, and then probably again in the fall. Wealth is, you know, as you know, Amy, it's a really vibrant community where we have trained existential kink coaches, and they often do guided practices, and, you know, Chai and I do Q&As, and we answer people's questions. We also do, we have a deep degree system where we progress through the arcana of the tarot, and we have monthly practices, and we have a book club, and basically it's just a lot of fun. And we have social events that are all about learning how to get off on every stroke, right? So we have a whole lot of fun through both learning and also just playing together. And it's, you know, it's $99 a month, which is like, I don't know, I pay that much for my cell phone bill. I think it's pretty reasonable for that much connection to other amazing magical leaders around the world. We practice the alchemy of learning to expand our having this level, learning to expand the amount of sensation that we can get off on. And what I really love about Wealth is, so much of how we get to have little teeny tiny having this levels is through social conditioning. So it really helps to be connected to a social group of other magical weirdos around the world who are working on getting off on everything, because that way you start be like, oh, okay, I can do this. Amy does this. I can do this. You know, it suddenly becomes like less bizarre and more accessible. So I love that about Wealth. And then if people really love existential kink, I have a program called Sovereigns, which is an existential kink coach training program. It's about a 9-month to a year long program. I'm not sure what the format of this one's going to be, but it's going to start in fall 2021. We're going to have live events in Miami interspersed with online teaching. I think we're accepting about 36 people for this one. And that's tremendously fun. We did our first iteration of it last year and I trained about 18 existential kink coaches, a lot of whom now work in Wealth. And they went through an amazing transformation. It was so beautiful to see these coaches come into like really, really deep self-love, which is, I think, one of the more amazing effects that people can get from existential kink. So there's that. And those would be my recommendations.
Perfect. I mean, I would recommend the same thing, having been through. It's something else that I think that you said that I just want to drive home for people. You've created this practice of EK where you get off on things that you probably normally wouldn't get off in normal society. You've created other things like DFI, deepest fear inventory, where you're going through all the things that you're like, I don't know if I can have this, but here we go. And all of these practices work, but you have to do them.
I know, right? Why? I know, that's always the kicker, isn't it?
That's like something else I found in Wealth, just like right before we get off here. If people are like, oh yeah, I'm only doing this. And I'm like, cool, that's your havingness level. There's like no judgment level on any of it within the space with each other. It's not like other courses where you feel like you're running to catch up, to finish the reading, to get the writing done, to do this, to do that. It's like, this is what my container can hold right now. And until I figure out how to open up that, I'm not going to judge myself for it. And my first month when I was allowed in the Mighty Networks, I was like a rabid beast, like going through the rest of the archives, like what else can I dig in and pull out of here? Because I was supposed to come in April, but I was doing three other courses because I am an overachiever and needed to do them. I needed pieces of paper. So I held off and I came in September. And then I would say like I got very close to burnout in December, because I was trying to do like three different Solve practices and three different Coagula practices and then read this chapter and read this whole book and just go through it and at the same time celebrate the holidays. And my husband was like, are you staying up till midnight every night? I was like, you don't understand. I have to do this journaling. Was so excited. So I will say, if you are one of those people who's like me and identifies with Hermione Granger as your spirit animal, and you step into this, you have to remove self-judgment, you have to give yourself patience, and you also have to do the practices, because if you don't do them, nothing happens.
Excellent words of wisdom, Amy. One second, gotta grab my Lulu. Mm-hmm.
Maybe I shouldn't let you guys go. I could talk all day.
Is there anything else you want to ask, Jer?
I think I'm good. Oh, hi, Lulu. Did you have some breakfast? Oh.
Yeah, she was just napping in the stroller.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, those are wise words, Amy, because there is a ton in Wealth. It's like a giant fire hose. And I do like to absolutely encourage people to just, you know, take what they want and leave the rest. The practices are really potent when you do them. So even if you're just choosing one little piece of it to focus on, you're going to see big results from that. Absolutely.
Awesome.
Yeah. Well, thank you guys. So
thank you for your time, Carolyn.
Yeah, such a pleasure getting to talk with you.
Mwah, you too.
Have a great day. See you around Wealth, Amy. Bye, okay. Jeremy.